This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's not on the top three list of things that you shouldn't talk about in polite company. Talking about feces probably comes in fourth behind religion, politics, and salaries. However, for a growing number of Americans suffering from debilitating illnesses of the gut, conversations about fecal matter are pretty much standard. Patients desperate for a cure for drug-resistant diseases like Clostridium difficile and incurable chronic diseases like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis are looking to fecal microbiota transplantation as a revolutionary way to reset their own microbiome and potentially save their lives. Emily Aiken is a freelance journalist and former senior editor at The New Yorker. She wrote about the emerging field of fecal transplants for The New Yorker. And Emily, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what is FMT, or fecal microbiota transplantation?
Yeah, well, most people call it FMT because it's such a mouthful to say. It's a procedure, a fairly crude one, in which stool is taken from a healthy person and transferred to the colon of someone who is sick.
Okay, so this is done with an incision? How do you transplant?
Actually, that's a really good question, because there are various ways to do it, and researchers are trying to figure out what is the most efficacious way to make that transfer. But people have tried nasogastric tubes, enemas, colonoscopes, and even capsules, which in the field are called crapsules of stool, as ways to get it into a sick patient.
I guess I'm not the only person who's immature about this. But what's transplanted? What does it do?
Well, it turns out fecal transplantations are the chief medical application we have right now, coming from this whole new field of science, the science of the microbiome, which is the study of the microbes that live inside us and outnumber our own cells by 9 to 1. Most of these microbes live in our gut. And what the research is showing is that they play a pivotal role in our health and can even be instrumental in treating disease. So our easiest access to them right now is through our poop.
Mm.
So a healthy person is eliminating microbes on a daily basis, most people, and those microbes turn out to be invaluable medical tools for treating certain kind of illnesses.
What's the history behind this treatment?
Well, it's a really interesting history, because the first known fecal transplants were done in China in something like the 4th century, where we actually have the first handbook of emergency medicine written by a 4th century Chinese physician. And in it, he mentions administering something called a yellow soup, which was a fecal suspension for the treatment of people who had severe diarrhea or food poisoning type conditions.
Okay, where to go from and, there?
Yeah, then it kind of disappears and resurfaces sometime in the Renaissance in Europe. There is an Italian anatomist who writes about what was called transfaunation, which was the use of fecal transplants in veterinary medicine. But there wasn't a lot of talk about using it in human beings in the West until about the 1950s. In 1958, in the United States, a surgeon in Colorado who noticed that his patients after surgery would often contract severe bacterial infections that were increasingly resistant to treatment with antibiotics, and some of them were very, very sick, even dying. And it occurred to him that he could try implanting healthy stool into their colons and as a possible treatment. He was desperate. And what he did was go to a nearby maternity ward where he knew there were young, presumably healthy women who had avoided antibiotics because they were pregnant. And he had a resident take stool from the maternity ward, bring it back to his surgical unit, and administer it to his patients. Dr. Eisman published 4 case reports at that time recounting the rather miraculous recovery of 4 of these patients who had received fecal transplants. Virtually within hours, they had recovered. And nobody picked up on this until, maybe the last 10 years or so, when simply the motive was simply more and more people, typically hospital patients, coming down with these antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections. And there was literally no obvious medical treatment. So in desperation, going through the case histories and finding Dr. Eisman's accounts led more and more doctors to think that they should try to do stool transplants.
How do hospitals and doctors obtain the material now that is then transplanted?
The new thing, the new source of access to stool in the last couple years has been this stool bank started by a couple of graduate students at MIT.
Oh, this is the open biome that you write about? What's the story there?
The story there is a graduate student at MIT named Mark Smith had a friend who had contracted Clostridium difficile, and his friend was young, in his 20s, an otherwise healthy man who needed to go to the hospital for gallbladder surgery. And when he came out sick with Clostridium difficile, and he underwent round after round of antibiotic treatments for his condition. He failed to improve and was, at a certain point, was unable to maintain his job. He was that sick. And had read about stool transplants, couldn't find a doctor to do one, eventually found a doctor who was at least willing to research the procedure, but was basically on a wait list for 6 months and ended up giving himself a stool transplant at home using his roommate's stool. So his friend, Mark Smith, thought this was just outrageous, that a treatment that was pretty universally available and known to be effective for the treatment of this particular condition was just so hard to get. So Mark Smith recruited a friend to help him start a stool bank modeled on a blood bank. The idea was, well, gee, these are young guys. They're at MIT. They know a lot of other healthy young researchers. They'll recruit them to provide stool anonymously. They'll screen these people, make sure they're healthy, make sure that their stool has no pathogens in it, and then they'll sell it just at a very low price to cover their costs to hospitals and clinics where these sick patients are.
We're speaking with the writer Emily Eakin, who wrote for The New Yorker about a controversial medical treatment called fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT. She wrote about the procedure and some of the patients who have benefited from it quickly and markedly. Do I dare ask how one does a DIY fecal transplant?
Yes. So first place they're apt to go is to the internet. There are literally dozens of how-to videos on YouTube that'll walk you through the equipment you need, how to do it at home, who to get your stool from. And then there are also support groups on Facebook where people who have done this, you know, trade suggestions with other people who want to do one. So there are sort of these underground networks for DIY fecal transplantation.
Well, any risks? I mean, any kind of DIY health procedure or medicinal procedure could have some risks, right?
Absolutely. So it's a little alarming that people are resorting to these DIY methods, and there have been a lot of anecdotes of people even using their pet feces when they were unable to find a donor. Some real real eyebrow-raising stories. However, the interesting thing is, for the most part, there have been very few reports of adverse events. There have been a couple of case reports of people contracting a virus or an infection following a fecal transplant. Whether it was directly tied to the fecal transplant hasn't been proven. But, of course, there are risks. And that is why doctors and the FDA stress that one should always be screened before you donate your stool to someone, or if you're a patient, before you accept a stool donation. You want to make sure the person you're getting stool from doesn't have a transmissible disease.
How effective is the treatment for C. diff patients?
It is it's incredibly effective. Doctors are amazed when they did the first randomized controlled trial involving fecal transplantation. The trial was published in January of 2013. Over 90% of the people who received a fecal transplant, as opposed to the standard antibiotic treatment or a placebo treatment, recovered. That's just a really high figure in medicine. I'm told that nothing in medicine has a cure rate of over 90%. And in fact, the trial was stopped early because it was determined that it was unethical to continue when the patients receiving the transplant were doing so well.
Huh. Are there other diseases that might be candidates for FMT?
Yes. So the field has moved on now from Clostridium difficile to looking at autoimmune diseases are a big subject that people are investigating. And, of course, that includes a whole host of conditions. The most prominent ones among autoimmune diseases that are likely to benefit are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, but people are also looking at conditions like allergies or autism. Children with autism have often horrible gut imbalances, microbial imbalances, and there have been case reports, again, just anecdotal at this point, no rigorous studies, I'm told, of children who've been treated with fecal transplants who also have autism and who recover verbal faculties following the treatment. So there's some tantalizing preliminary evidence that this sort of treatment is likely to benefit other conditions.
Well, it just sounds like an amazing story. But why do you think, Emily, it's such a challenge to get treatment for patients? I mean, is it about people feeling uncomfortable talking about poop?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I read that there's one study that it was really a survey of patients and physicians that found that the biggest obstacle to treatment was not the patients, but the physicians. The patients who were candidates for fecal transplants quickly overcame their reflexive revulsion at the idea. It was the physicians who thought, gee, this is messy and disgusting. I don't really want to be working with poop. But apparently that attitude is changing. And Open Biome, the stool bank, is growing at something like 18% a month in terms of its clientele. So it started out with just a couple of clinics and hospitals and now ships stool to 36 states. I mean, that figure is now a month out of date, probably. That's probably changed. So I think fecal transplants is increasingly big business, and I think it's available just about in any big hospital in this country. But I think it's also worth saying that a fecal transplant is still a very crude procedure. We don't know which microbes in our guts are the ones that are truly beneficial. So you get them all when you get a dose of stool. Mm-hmm. And in the future, the treatment is likely to be much more streamlined and concentrated. So the 15 really effective microbes for your condition will probably be filtered out into a pill that you swallow.
Well, Emily, what a story. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Emily Egan is a freelance writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker. You'll find a link to read her article, The Excrement Experiment. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stick around for more Word of Mouth. When we return, we'll find out what happens when composing a really bad Christmas song landed the gentle-hearted Sean Hurley on an inflammatory commercial radio show. Santa meets the Shock Jocks after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Really bad Christmas songs are just one of the signs of the season and can quickly puncture the holiday spirit with a deep internal groan. NHPR's Sean Hurley discovered this himself when he decided to compose a new Christmas carol. Sean brought his composition, the Christmas La La Song, to Sirius XM Shock Jocks Opie and Anthony for an audition. This was back in 2008. We'll let Sean pick it up from there, but a reminder that these are the brand of radio personalities who live to inflame.
In 2006, I started doing a storytelling podcast called Atoms, Motion, and the Void.
Generally, when I have the urge to walk, it is directly away from the cop.
I mixed together stories I'd written with music that I liked. I didn't use my own voice, but that of an alter ego, who I called Sherwin Sleeves.
You mean this isn't your voice?
Well, it's a voice that I do, but it's an imaginary voice.
Disturbing.
I created a website and posted a few episodes, but then I couldn't figure out how to get anyone to listen to them.
No one listened. No one cared.
At the same time, I was listening to a daily comedy show on XM Satellite Radio.
Buddies, it's the Ron Fez Show, 866.
The host, Ron Bennington, had fast become a kind of radio hero to me. He was street smart and brilliant, and no matter how cutting he was, he couldn't hide the fact that he had a huge heart. Bennington also played songs as listeners sent in. He'd plug their websites, if they had them, as a kind of payment. So I thought I could bring two birds to life with one stone. I could support a show I loved while grabbing a little attention for my podcast. So I started sending in ridiculous songs.
Ladies and gentlemen of the American phenomenon, like puppets in the Sesame Street, with big phenomenon.
Professor Bunsen, I presume. Of the world-class Ogilvies. There's nothing left to ruin here at Muppet University. Oh,
here's my... In November of 2008, Bennington asked me to write a Christmas song. I tried, hard, but the subject was so done and so burnt to a saccharine crisp, I was finding it impossible. I was literally revolting myself with the songs I was coming up with. But then, while working on another song, I stumbled across a little melody that seemed promising. I worked it up into a song and sent it off. Ron played it, and that's where the trouble began. Ron and Fez shared their channel on satellite radio with the infamous shock radio duo Opie and Anthony. Opie heard the song on the Ron and Fez show and decided to play it on his show.
They played a song by Sleeves. Have you heard his song yet? Sleeves did a song called Christmas Song. And I can't get this damn thing out of my head.
I was feeling pretty good for la 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 la. Taking my time on the la 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 la.
Opie loved it. But Anthony?
That sucked so bad. Dude. I'm being completely honest with you. I'm not even doing this for a bit.
Right.
I hate it.
Then they went to the phones. Bonnie in D.C. liked it.
It actually made me choke up, almost cry in my car. Loved it.
But Melissa in Jersey, not so much.
Hey, Anthony, I gotta agree with you. That song is absolutely horrendous. Never heard a song as bad as that.
I gotta tell you, the phones, every single one is lit. Half of them love it, and the other half hate it. I mean, it's right down the middle.
I didn't know it at the time, but I had created the musical equivalent of Elf on a Shelf. And it didn't end there. Christmas, 2009.
Maybe we should play some Sleeves.
Oh, no!
I think it's time for a little Christmas song from Sleeves.
I haven't heard that in so long, and I hate
it.
Remember that
Come
one?
Come on, let's try it again this year.
Remember that one?
Opie still loved it. The callers loved and hated it. And Anthony?
That sucks.
That rules.
Sleeves. God damn.
I'm sorry.
No.
Why? Too much emotion going on?
No, it has nothing to do with emotion. I was feeling pretty good in the la 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 la.
Yeah.
What's a la 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 la?
The Christmas.
If he came up in a half place,
Christmas season.
I was feeling pretty good, sitting in my house, and then he's got to rhyme something.
See, that's it. Why didn't you rhyme something?
Well, I was just a singer. You were the lyricist.
Oh, that's true. Why didn't I rhyme something? Anyway, they played it the next year.
What's a la 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 la?
Why is it not? It's got to mean something.
It's the season in general.
No.
And the year after that.
Stick it through the window and a la 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 la. An empty boat and a la 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 la.
Year after year.
Oh, shut up. I can't take it anymore. God. I enjoyed being told my father was dead more than this. Enjoy the sound of that.
What is wrong with
this? This is horrible.
It's not horrible.
It's terrible.
It's really not.
Stinks. Look across the bay. It's snowing, you dummy.
That's why it's cool.
Go inside. I hate this guy.
I worried early on that Anthony's contempt would mean that soon no one would like the song. Not that he could brainwash anyone into agreeing with him, but that maybe that innocent moment where you get to decide things for yourself was being blown to bits. But that's not what happened. And over the last 5 years, in a very small way, I got to see how people are strong like that. Like the Who's down in Whoville. Like the people who love Elf on a Shelf no matter what. It might not be a good song. It might even be an awful song. But it's just an elf on a shelf. And it means whatever you want it to mean. Just like the La 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 La's. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley. And I am Sherwin Sleeves.
I like to drink a little beer.
Well, it's here. Tis the season for cliches, just like that, and for Christmas carols and wrapping presents and eggnog and parties, and for many parents, questions about old Saint Nick. Motherload blogger KJ Dell'Antonia fills us in a choice that many parents find either naughty or nice. That's when Word of Mouth returns, after a quick break.
And the people in the light. All the children in the light singing holy, holy night.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before we get into our next segment, a warning. No, we're not going to be talking about anything sordid or using harsh language, but we will be discussing Santa. So if you're with your kids right now, here is your warning. We're going to be talking about Santa. Okay, we'll give you just a moment. Christmas brings with it festive lights and decorated trees and parties, and for some parents, a conundrum. Whether or not to protect the identity of Santa Claus. Joining me now to talk about how parents navigate this Santa story is KJ Dell'Antonia. She's editor and lead writer of the Motherload blog for the New York Times. KJ, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we raise children, telling them that lying is wrong. So what about the Santa story? Where does that fit in?
Where does that fit in? That, I don't know what you're talking about, Virginia.
Okay, KJ, we're not protecting your diplomatic immunity for this story.
Well, you know, that really just fits into our culture. That is joining in a collective and joyful set of varying mythologies about the season that I personally happen to love.
Ah, okay. Well, it has been going on for a long time, but it seems like it's coming up increasingly as an issue for today's parents. Would you observe that?
I do, yeah. We get a lot of letters from parents wanting to know, you know, how other people have handled it. Their children are young. I think there is that moment when your kids are really very, very little, and you're either going down this road or you're not. And so people have some struggle with that. And then, of course, there's the moment at the other end of the road that some people have in which their children are, rudely yanked from the mythology or just come out of it themselves or really in some way just sort of never. I've known some children who've never come to it at all. It just, you know, it just didn't work for them.
Well, isn't it often true, though, that the older kids kind of have a different belief about Santa and may take some pleasure in either protecting that belief or in, I don't know, spilling the goods to the younger kids?
I think that can go either way. We'll be running an essay on Sunday from a regular contributor of ours, Jess Leahy, whose son at 8 came home and having had a classmate pop the bubble for him. and was really upset about it, but came around to wanting to enjoy doing it with his younger brother, who was, I think, 4 at the time. So, you know, it's a nice story. And I've also had parents write in and say, you know, that their older kids, sometimes their older kids would say something to the younger kids, and the younger kids would be like, yeah, all right, I knew that. Sorry. Like, it would be a big deal for an older child, but not for the younger child. Uh-huh. I don't know why that would be.
That's interesting. But never mind siblings. How about parents who often construct elaborate staging, you know, with Santa footprints and cookie crumbs and the elf on the shelf? First of all, what is the elf on the shelf?
My favorite Santa staging, I have to tell you, first of all, though, is the reindeer poop. But we'll skip that.
Where does one get it?
I suspect you could Google a recipe. I really do. I honestly think that is out there. But okay, the elf on the shelf. What the elf on the shelf does is it apparently moves around the house, conducting pranks, and also keeping an eye on the children if you decide to go that route, and reporting back to Santa on whether or not they've been naughty or nice. And let me tell you, that is another piece of this that parents go different ways about. Some parents, you know, full-on embrace, I'm calling Santa. Mm-hmm. I heard a friend yelling that at her 4-year-old just the other day. And on the other hand, we've got another essay coming up, because this is the season for essays about the holidays. We've got another essay coming back about a woman who took her daughter in, who was very sensitive little girl, and took her into the mall Santa and sort of gave the mall Santa a desperate look and said, there's not really a naughty list, is there, Santa? Even people who are a little naughty might get presents. Right, Santa? And, you know, bless that Santa. He said, oh, no, all the little children who love me get presents, or whatever. So that's one that parents struggle with as well. It's not just the whole overarching thing. It's, in some ways, it's the details. They really vary from family to family.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're discussing Santa, specifically how parents choose to talk with their kids about Santa. KJ Del Antonio is with us. She's editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. Is there a way to tell the Santa story without the mythology? I'll use your word.
I don't think so. I really don't. I think that you can, and I have known parents who have just started in with, you know, this is something that other families do and not us. And of course, if you're a Jewish family, or if you're you don't celebrate Christmas for any other reason, maybe you don't want this. And from that, and for those families, from day one, it's, you know, this is something that other families do. But I think if you're going to do it, I don't know, I think it's all in. I suppose it could be, I don't see any reason to go down that road, mm-hmm, if you're not all in.
Well, it's funny, because I've talked to a couple of people who say, you know, I want, you know, radical honesty in my family. But then the kid goes walking around in preschool and says,
yes,
you know, and then some problems come back. You have to navigate it with the extended family. You have to deal with other parents or school. So how do you make that choice?
You know, if you are that parent, it does take some conversations with your child, unless you want your child to be that child at preschool. And I'll tell you, that's not really a popular child to be this time of year. I've definitely sat down with friends in the past, because now I'm not worried about it. It is what it is for us. But and said, you know, can I just remind you to remind Dory that, you know, we're still happily doing this. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, no problem. We'll talk, mm-hmm, to them before we come over.
I don't know. You just said, KJ, you just said it is what it is. Are we overthinking this? I mean, people who refuse to toe the line, applying a kind of, you know, adult rigor or demand for the truth, that's not really necessary in this case.
I'm inclined to think so, but it really is a very, very personal. It's a funny thing to say, oh, this is a personal choice, Virginia. But it is. And maybe it comes down to the heart of how you are, you know, raising your family in some ways. And, you know, I wouldn't want to say that there's stuff that goes unspoken and that's the way it ought to be, because most stuff should not fall into that category. But, you know, I don't know, let's look at it really nicely and say that in some families, there's just this deeper understanding that we're all enjoying this, so let's do it together.
KJ Del Antonio's editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. She lives in New Hampshire. We're so happy to have her.
Thank you.
Is that you, Santa Claus?
Okay, so KJ is clearly on the let's all embrace the magic of Santa side of the fence. And now we peer over that fence for another perspective. But before we get to that, a warning to parents that we are talking about Santa, specifically how parents choose to talk to their kids about Santa's identity. Well, so you've been warned. Okay, back to that kid who went around telling the entire preschool that there is no Santa. Well, that child's father is not ashamed, but we have chosen to protect his identity by altering his voice. After all, who knows what damage and parental ire might be the result of a Santa expose? We spoke to him in secret earlier this week. So you are the mysterious person that I identified when I spoke with KJ, whose child, I won't specify the gender, stirred things up a little bit in preschool because he told kids that Santa was not real. Or what did he say? Or it say?
They were talking about what they wanted for Christmas and what they were going to do at Christmas and what they were looking forward to about Christmas. And my child told the others, Santa's not coming to your house. Santa isn't real. Of course, the other kids pushed back and said, well, of course Santa's real. Santa comes to my house every Christmas and brings me presents. And my kid said, no, Santa doesn't do that. Santa's not real. The longer the conversation went on, the more strident the kid got about it. And when I heard about what had happened, I was mortified because I have never said one way or the other anything about Santa. I have neither confirmed nor denied the existence of Santa to this child.
So where did it come from? You had no idea?
I had no idea. I mean, I have a rule that I don't lie to the kid about anything. I will give an age-appropriate answer to any question asked. And that includes what goes on at Christmas time. That said, I have never said that Santa isn't real, and I have certainly never said that you should tell other kids that Santa isn't real.
Mm-hmm. But if you have this policy of sort of, I don't know, radical honesty, one could call it, not ever telling or propagating a myth to your child, there are consequences that come with it, right? I mean, is this the first time anything like this has happened?
It was the first time I had ever thought about it. It was the piece I had never thought to consider. And that's what's really interesting. Whatever it is that you instill in a kid may or may not stick because of the messages they're getting from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
The same, I think a lot of parents have had the same consequence with gender.
Right.
You know, there are parents who have daughters and they say, well, my kid is going to be interested in science and technology and she's going to be an engineer. And then, you know, lo and behold, they have a 2-year-old girl who says, I want to play with princesses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nothing that came from them. It came from one of the other forces in their lives.
So what was the conversation that you had with your child after this?
Well, we sat down and I said, I hear you were talking with the other kids about Santa today. And I know that we don't talk about Santa the way the other kids do, but we talk a lot about politeness. That's the other big value that we have along with honesty. We don't lie, but we also always try to be considerate of other people. And I said, if other kids want to believe in Santa and other kids want to have that as a fun thing, we don't want to be the ones to take that away from them. And the response I got was, no, they can't do that.
Hmm.
And I said, well, that just isn't very polite, is it, to talk that way to other kids? What if we just say that for us, we'll talk about Santa in our own way, and they can talk about Santa in their way?
Hmm. So what if your child were to say to you, I really love Santa and want to believe in Santa, what would you do with that?
Well, that's the funny part, because a couple of weeks after this happened, we were talking, we were decorating our tree and listening to Christmas music. And out of the blue, and this had not come up again since this incident, out of the blue, I hear, "And you know who's coming on Christmas, right? Santa! Yay!"
So the teachable moment may not have been exactly the moment that you anticipated, that this would be about telling the truth to your child, and instead would be about child finding child's own way.
I think that's what it has come down to, because as much as it, as important as it is for me to be honest, and this is going to sound like a cop-out, my job is not to be the last honest parent, to be the one who spoils and pours cold water on all of the fun of childhood. Because for a lot of kids, Santa really is fun. And I certainly don't want to take that away from anybody. My only goal is that, as a parent, that I am somebody that my kid can come to and answer, can ask any question about any topic, and that I will do my best to answer it, and that that will always be available in our household, in our family.
Well, thank you, mystery guest.
It has been a pleasure sharing my mysterious family dynamic with you.
And mystery guest's voice was disguised not out of shame, but for protection of the family.
I'm a Christmas unicorn in a uniform made of gold, with a billy goat beard and a sorcerer's shield and a mistletoe on my nose.
So there you have it. Clearly, Santa Claus is not a one-size-fits-all proposition for parents. And we'd love to hear from you. How do you talk to your kids about jolly Saint Nick? Have you gone all in, tracking his movements online? Did your parents go all in? Or are you letting your kids ponder Santa in their own way? You can join the ongoing conversation. It's on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Inspiring kids to nurture their own imaginations and seek out truths that can be proven is one of the goals of quality science education. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll talk to a scientist and former toy designer who helps students come up with off-the-beaten-path science fair projects. It's another good gig when Word of Mouth continues.
I don't exist, for I make no apology for the category.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. One tactic for getting kids excited about STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, and math subjects, is to encourage them to get their hands dirty, doing experiments, making things, and then showing their work off at science fairs. Building robotic vehicles has been especially successful, but a bigger draw for boys than for girls. Today's Good Gig guest works to encourage girls in the computer science and math areas for a company called Science Buddies. Science Buddies gives kids ideas and guidance for science fair projects that deviate from the well-trod robotics and erupting volcano paths. Howard Eglestein, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia.
Well, Howard, we first learned about you as one of the collaborators on the Luminous Firefly dress. So I'm having trouble figuring out what you are, an inventor, engineer, designer, scientist?
I like to think that I'm a recovering toy designer. I started doing electronic toys back in the 80s. Back in the days of the Coleco Cabbage Patch Kids, if anybody remembers them. And I did a bunch of work at the group, which is now known as the MIT Media Lab.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a background of creating things out of nothing, taking odd scraps and turning them into something fun, and trying to bring life into things that didn't have life in the first place.
How's the recovery going?
I really want to go toys again. I really want to. It's not working well.
So you have translated this into making projects or helping to create projects for Science Buddies. Tell us what Science Buddies actually does.
Science Buddies is a website of ideas and a gentle push for kids that probably wouldn't be science kids, probably are not the kids that would join a robotics competition, for example, because they're just not engineering science kids. They have interests. They don't really know where to go. Perhaps they don't have a mom or dad or an older brother or sister at the house who knows anything about this stuff. And they want to do something great for a science fair, but they just don't know where to start.
Okay, so what kind of projects might one find on a Science Buddy site?
Well, we have something over 1,000 of them. And They cover genetics and botany, chemistry, physics. They started doing some things with robotics and electrical engineering and found that the kind of stale projects that you, the vehicles, they just weren't appealing to half of the audience. I mean, the girls are really interested in this stuff, but they just don't want to build vehicles.
So what in particular are they more interested in, girls in general?
They generally like art and music. If you can make a robot that plays music or a robot that draws art, that's a much bigger draw for a girl than it is for the boys.
So what kind of things have you designed specifically for girls?
Specifically for girls, I would say the most recent one would be trying to educate the kids on what RFID is, which is radio frequency identification. We see it all the time. In department stores, they put on special tags that keep you from leaving the store. Mm-hmm. But it's also used for other things. We put it in credit cards now, so you can just wave the credit card at a machine and it reads. But that's not a very accessible technology for kids. They can't play with that stuff. But there are hobbyist versions of that. And so what I did was I used the hobbyist version of an RFID reader, which you can buy just over the web, and you connect it up to your computer and you use it to control sound clips. And then you can make a musical instrument out of it.
Okay, so you used it for handbells. Let's hear just a sample of that. So that's Mary had a little lamp played on the handbells. And how are the RFID tags used?
Well, I don't know if those were the original bells or if those were the recordings, because mm-hmm. you can't really tell. But the idea is that once the computer sees that the RFID tag has been identified, it can then use that information however it wants. So in this particular case, it wants to play a sound, and it knows which sound to play because it identified which tag was placed in front of the reader.
Handbells may have limited appeal for kids, though, so you made some alterations.
Right. So there's a couple of ways you can alter a project like that to make it more fascinating for kids. One is that you can make it a different shape. And I've been talking with one student who's making a stringed instrument that you trigger with RFID tags. And I cannot wait to see pictures because I'm having trouble understanding what he's up to. But the other way of looking at it is it doesn't have to sound like a bell.
Okay, so we've got some examples of your alterations, let's say, to this RFID-controlled instrument. Let's first hear this. Cows.
Cows, yes. Cows are funny. And so what happened was that we wanted to come up with other things that the bells could sound like. Or if you're going to turn it into some other shape, it might not be appropriate to sound like a bell anyway. Hmm. But we also know that the students aren't going to have access to, you know, sound equipment like you guys have here or that I have at home. So we also needed to provide the sounds in a sort of pre-made way that the kids could use easily.
I wonder for you, Howard, when you're sort of envisioning, I guess you have to look through a child's brain to think about things that they'd be interested in. How does that work for you?
Well, as I said, I'm a recovering toy designer, so it's not that difficult to sort of imagine what might be fun for a kid, what would be a challenge. One of the things that we do is we make sure that we push them in the right direction, and we push them far enough to get them excited to want to finish the journey, but we don't want to do it for them.
Now, I'm glad you said that, because I looked at Science Buddies and I thought, well, aren't kids supposed to come up with their own science project ideas? This is sort of like presenting them with the ideas.
Some of ours are very hand-holding, and some of them are not. And I tend to make mine for the 9th through 12th grade group, and I try not to handhold too much.
How do you know what happens with these projects? Do they come back and circle around to you and tell you what they've done?
Sometimes. In order to make these sounds available, I also put together a site where I collect the sounds separately so additional sounds are available. It's called anoctaveofcows.org, and people that want to play with it are welcome to investigate, and I'm always looking for new octaves of sounds. And one of the students went through that site, found the contact information. I've been discussing his project separately. And he's the one that wants to make a stringed instrument synthesizer out of the RFID tags.
I wonder what you made when you were a kid for science fair projects.
Actually, our school didn't have science fairs. And I think that's one of the reasons why I find this position so appealing, because it does encourage you to, you know, step away from whatever it is that you did. And I was actually a music kid growing up, and get involved in playing with things that you wouldn't otherwise play with.
Well, Howard Eglestein, thank you so much for talking about your gig.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Howard Eglestein is actually principal engineer at Yankee Scientific, but he's also a developer for Science Buddies. You can find more on our conversation, including the link to Science Buddies and anoctaveofcows.org. Thanks so much for listening today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. And as we continue our series on good gigs, we would love to hear from you. Do you have a dream job? Or do you know somebody with an unusually awesome gig? If so, shoot us an email. Our email address is wordofmouth@nhpr.org. That's wordofmouth@nhpr.org. And put good gig in the subject line. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.